Jesus Christ,
your Son. Amen. Amen. And speaking of pain and suffering, Chris Pontino is up there. It's about 25 degrees hotter. So it's about 78 down here at 25, about 103 degrees. So thank you, Chris, for suffering for our sake. Now, am I using this mic only and this one doesn't matter anymore?
Yes.
Okay, great. So I can move around. That's great. Anyway, it's good to be here. I last spoke for the church, I think it was 13 years ago. My daughter was interviewing, or was coming, she thought about going to UC Davis. And so it's been a while. And who was it that was leading the church back then? He ended up with some serious medical issues. Drew, the Nitschovs were here at the time. All right, great. So I was asked to speak on the question, that sort of the apologetic question about pain and suffering. Chris, could we work the PowerPoint? Like I said, we can do it without a PowerPoint. Ron Brumley, who died recently, he said, he was a principal, he said, "This is my PowerPoint." As a principal. All right, great. Let's get to the first slide. All right, so we're going to talk about the question of the biblical question and the broader question about pain and suffering, but we're also going to talk about the problem of evil, which are related. Could we move forward, please? All right, so we're going to look at two aspects. You don't need to see me. I don't know. I mean, I turned it on. I pushed the button. I hit the thing. Yeah, it says on. It says it's on. The green light is on. All right, so I'll keep going for now, and if we have to adjust. All right, so the talk will be broken down into two parts. The first part I'll talk about the apologetics. By the way, apologetics doesn't mean I apologize. It means to explain, all right? So I'm going to talk about the intellectual response. So what is the logical response to this question that I'm going to raise in a minute? And I believe, though, that's not the question that really matters to most people. I'm going to spend more time on that. But then I'm going to talk about the human or the Chris, could we just do this thing? Yeah. Okay, great. So let's get down to the question. All right, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to take the perspective of the unbeliever, and I'm going to ask you a couple of questions. Be careful how you answer these questions. Okay? The God that you believe in, is that God all-powerful? We say omniscient. Could that God do whatever he wanted?
Yeah.
Help me out. Yes or no?
Yes.
Okay, good. All right, is that God a loving God? In fact, is that God so much loving that love is defined by that God?
Yes.
All right, then I say that God is certainly not real. Can't be. Because, you know, a child is born and has serious birth defects, suffers for 3 or 4 weeks and then dies, and the parents go through great suffering. So help me out here. Either it's because God doesn't care, or it's because God is not powerful to prevent that. Because obviously, that's not consistent with the God that you described. And what about the collapse of that tower in Florida? You say that the God you believe in is all-powerful and is so loving, so why would he just let those people be crushed? I mean, there's a problem here. And if this problem, if you've never thought of this problem, then you should have, believer. If you've never thought of this problem, then, you know, as a Christian, maybe you need to be a bit more of a thinker. So the agnostic or the atheist says, the God that you talk about, the God who is all-powerful and all-loving, is inconsistent with the reality that we know about. It's a serious question. And by the way, we'll see that God does not ignore this question in the Bible. But one thing for sure is, there's a lot of suffering. And, you know, we're not going to have easy answers to these questions. Anybody who tells you, Oh, yeah, yeah, that's not a hard question. Let me explain it to you, blah, blah, blah. And just walk away. Don't listen to that person. And I'll tell you this, even at the end of part A, if you will, of our presentation, in which I provide a defense of the God of the Bible in view of these things, even at the end of that, there's still the fact that somebody dies or somebody suffers severe pain and gets cancer. And at some point, emotionally, that's still a problem. That's still a problem. All right? Somebody lost her mom just a week ago. And I'm telling you, what she needs right now is not part A of this talk. You know, explaining to her why that's not inconsistent with the God that we know about. What she needs is a hug. And we'll talk about that. One thing for sure is there are a lot of different kinds of suffering. Chris, could you kind of be... Yeah. All right, so we'll talk about different kinds of suffering. And we're going to deal with some questions. Because I believe there are assumptions that are made here. For example, the one implied assumption in this critique is that suffering is bad or evil. Of course, to the agnostic or the atheist, the word evil has no actual real meaning. You can't even define evil in atheism. And another question is, these things, are they really God's responsibility? Now, in the big picture, of course, anything that happens is God's responsibility. In the big picture, right? I mean, he did create the universe. All right, but on Judgment Day, if you're going to try to blame God for your sin, good luck having that little argument. I don't think it's going to work that way. There's a lot of kind of suffering. There's chronic pain. You know, the fact that, you know, I took a chunk out of my finger. I was messing with my thing, and it's just blood, you know, whatever. That does not create a philosophical problem for me. Not at all. But how about somebody who has such incredible back pain that they can't even really do anything? They just lay there in pain for years and years and years. And then, whoop-de-doo, they die. So chronic pain, that's a kind of suffering. That's a real kind of suffering. Could we forward the slide? Okay. And then there's diseases. And again, having a cold or, you know, a little sniffles or something like that. But, you know, if God loves us, why did he create COVID? I mean, which part? You know, you got those lists of God's qualities, right? His omniscience, his omnipotence, his holiness, his justice. You got all those lists of qualities. Under which of those qualities does COVID-19 fall? Christian, how do you explain that? And you got to admit, that's a reasonable question. You know, I've done a talk, I actually did a debate once on the existence of God, and I was trounced because I took the position that God is not real. All right, and my opponent took the position, you know, he was a high school student. But anyway, that's a true story, but supposed to be funny at the same time. But almost all arguments for the existence of God are either just pure rhetoric or so easily responded to. Seriously, people actually wonder about that. But this question here, this is a real question, a difficult one. There are other kinds of suffering. There's broken relationships. Okay, why does God allow for things like emotional devastation, loneliness? You know, when I was a kid, my mother said to me, sticks and stones can break my bones, but words could never hurt me. That's the biggest lie. That's a bunch of baloney. Those words hurt worse than sticks and stones. And there's poverty. Why does God allow for, you know, 3 billion people to live in extreme utter poverty, barely able to even find their next meal? What about violence? What about what happened in Haiti just yesterday? What about genocide? Is it because God didn't care about the Jews in the 1940s? Or because he was powerless to prevent it? And it seems like those are the only two alternatives, at least at first. And then there's, violence, there's sexual abuse, physical abuse, emotional abuse. And then there's the chronic fear. Some of you right now in your life live with a chronic fear. It's something that happened 10, 20, 30 years ago, and it's still, you're suffering. You suffer every day because of that, even though it's an event from the past. Why doesn't God sort of wave a magic wand on that thing? And then after all that, then you get death. Okay, there you go. That's how it all rolls up at the end. How is that consistent? Let's look at some pictures to kind of represent different kinds of suffering. Okay, there's violence. Okay, poverty. Starvation. Genocide. Yes, the Armenian genocide, that's a real thing. I don't care what the government in Turkey says. Sexual abuse. Many different kinds of suffering. Loneliness. Next slide. All right, bottom line is there's a lot of suffering in this world. So how is that consistent with the God that we read about in the Bible? Is it because God does not really actually care about these sorts of things? It's like, that's not really my problem. Or is it he cares greatly, but is powerless to deal with it? Okay? So I want to talk about the causes of suffering. And again, remember, I'm going to deal with the sort of the intellectual, the up here answer to this question. I'm going to tell you my conclusion before I start. I believe Christianity and arguably Judaism offers the only rational response to this question. All right? That makes sense and that is satisfying. All right? And so let's talk about that. Next slide. All right, some of the causes of suffering. We'll talk about free will. We'll talk about sin. We'll talk about natural disasters, natural law. Next slide. Okay, great. So let's talk about free will for a bit. All right, do you believe in free will?
Yeah.
Okay, why do you believe in free will? Because your experience tells you, you just decided, you know, could you please raise your hand? Yeah, there you go. So did I make you raise your hand? No, okay, yeah. I mean, we believe in free will because the human experience tells us that is the reality. We know that we have free will. Of course, it's also in the Bible. Deuteronomy 30 would be an example. We could go to, the one in Joshua, choose this day who you will serve. As for me, my house will serve the Lord. But I like Deuteronomy 30 as my favorite one. To kind of show biblically. By the way, the phrase free will is not found in the Bible. Just so you know, you can do a Bible search and not in any translation that I know of. All right? But anyway, verse 19 of Deuteronomy 30. This day I call the heavens and the earth as witnesses against you that I've put before you life and death, blessings and curses. Now choose life. So that you and your children may live, that you may love the Lord your God, listen to his voice, hold fast to him, for the Lord is your life, and he'll give you many years in the land he swore to give your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And when I read that passage, I feel a lot of emotion. God's saying, look, I'm putting before you today life and death. Blessings and curses. And he's begging us. Thank you. Thank you. He's begging us to make the right choice. Why did God give us free will? Because he loves us. In fact, can you force somebody to love you? No, it is literally impossible. In fact, a deeper question, why do we exist at all? According to the Bible, not according to atheists or Buddhists or whoever. According to the Bible, why do we exist? It's right there in Genesis chapter 2. So that God could love us, so that we could love him, and that we could love one another. The very reason we exist. Right, in fact, I would challenge the atheist on this who says that a loving God would not allow these things to happen. Either that, or maybe he doesn't want it to, but he can't do anything about it. I would say God is so loving and so powerful that he made us. And he gave us free will. You know, there were two trees in the garden. Why did he put that tree of the knowledge of good and evil in there? Because he loved us. And he gave Adam and Eve a choice. We have a wider range of choices than Adam and Eve did, because unfortunately we acquired a certain kind of knowledge, you know, and it seems to kind of come in genetically. By the way, we did not inherit the sin of Adam. That's Calvinism. But we inherited a kind of knowledge of good and evil, right? That's, you know, whether it's literally from that tree or I don't know how metaphorical and literal it is. All I know is it's real. That's for sure. So that's the first part of my answer to this question. And I would say to the atheist or the person who doesn't believe in God, you know, what would be the alternative? All right, what would be the alternative? That we would be automatons, that it would be a deterministic universe, which is what the atheists believe. And, you know, God loved us. God took a huge risk. All parents know what we're talking about, right? Why did you bring children into the world? Because you didn't have anything better to do with your money? Because you were bored? I mean, why would anybody have a child except because they had sex and that it just happened? But other than that, why would anybody have a child? Why? Because they want to love their child. And they want their child to love them. And they want their child to experience love. So, the prodigal son, can we go to the next slide? I can't remember what the next slide is. Okay. Well, and we could talk about free will. I believe that is Thomas Aquinas. He's giving his little take, if you will, on free will. Thomas Aquinas, because you have to understand, you know, there's this whole thing with Augustine and you know, predestination and all that kind of stuff. Thomas Aquinas kind of gave a biblical philosophical defense of the idea of free will. Because, see, the Calvinist, the predestinationist says, God's will always happens. God's will dominates. Well, that's not true. Because what's it say? What's that prayer that Jesus said, your will be done, right? Why would you pray for God's will to be done if it's always done? All right, Augustine and Calvin overly emphasize God's sovereignty over his love. All right, the way Thomas Aquinas said it is, God's sovereignty is such that he could give sovereignty to us. It's his sovereign will that we have free will. And the fact that we do something against God's will does not mean that God's will is not always done. Because God's will is that we have free will. In fact, everything God ever created obeys him. All right? The stars obey him. The trees obey him. Your dog may not obey you, but your dog obeys God. The only thing he created that doesn't obey him is us. The prodigal son, the story of the prodigal son is such a beautiful illustration of the idea of free will. You know, God took a huge risk because he knew that if he gave us a choice, which he had to in order for us to love him, that we might reject him, and we sure did. And in fact, most of us did. And it pains God deeply. Think about parents who control their kids way too much. Maybe you know a parents like that, or maybe you're one of those parents. All right. And why do parents overly control their kids? Well, they think they're doing it because they love them. But if they love them, they would let them go. All right. And besides, when they finally get out of the house, they don't know what to do and they go crazy. But that's a whole other story. OK, great. So, by the way, I've not explained why there is suffering. All I've done so far is create a case based on experience and on the Bible for the fact that we have free will and why we have free will. It's because God is super awesome, incredibly powerful, and loving. So that is certainly consistent with the God that we talked about. All right, now what about suffering? I believe that most suffering, could we have the next slide, please? It might be two slides. Yeah, let's go a little farther. All right. By the way, can we just have the, you don't need me, can we just have the PowerPoint? Is that a possibility? I mean, they can see me already. Oh, is that because of people online? The online people, they don't need to see me either. They already saw me for about 15 minutes. You know, I'll look kind of the same, maybe a little bit more sweat. I was teaching in Togo about 3 years ago, and it was about 100 degrees and about 100% humidity. And after, because in Africa, you know, here, if you go for more than 45 minutes, people are kind of doing this. But in Africa, I was teaching for two and a half hours straight, and my shirt, it was just, the sweat was just running off my shirt. And so they sent me back to get a new shirt. Why bother? Because 10 minutes later. So anyway, this is nothing. This is not suffering at all. All right. So I believe, okay, apologetics and evil. We can talk about evil. I'm getting a little bit. My notes say one thing and the PowerPoint says something else. That's why that's happening. Okay, let's back up a little bit. Because, like I said, there's really arguably two separate apologetic questions. One is, why is there evil? And then the other one is, why is there pain and suffering? All right? And again, an all-powerful God, an all-loving God, why does he allow for evil? Why does he allow humans to do evil? And the answer is, because he loves us. Why is there evil in the world? Very simple. Because God loves us. Why did he put that tree in the garden? Because he loves us. And if we try to explain why there's evil in the world, I'm supposed to say within a certain range there. Okay, cool. But then I can't move around. All right. All right, so fine. Fine then. Just kidding. All right, yeah. All right. So, how does the atheist explain evil? Well, the way they explain evil is by saying there's no such thing. Okay? Because if there is no source of moral authority, then evil is literally impossible to define. All right, so how does the Hindu or how does the Buddhist explain evil? Well, if you study Hinduism, you'll see that evil is an illusion. All right, it's an illusion. All right, well, that doesn't solve the problem of evil as well. I don't have time to go into this, but I'm going to go to the next slide, in fact. But I believe that Christianity and arguably Judaism, and you could even defend Islam as able to explain the question of evil. I think you could defend that. That outside of that, it doesn't really make sense. All right, so are we going to go to the next slide? Awesome. Okay, and the next one after that. Okay. Evil is real, and it's because God loves us. Next slide. Okay. Cause of human suffering. Now, I'm going to argue that most suffering in the world is because of rebellion. Okay? Most of the pain and suffering is not because of lack of love on God's part, or lack of power on God's part, but in his power and his love, he gave us a choice, and we rebelled, and we brought suffering into the world. And again, like I said, almost all, but not all, that's not the whole question, almost all, a large majority of suffering is due to sin. How much suffering is the result of addiction? How much suffering is the result of lack of self-control? How about sexual perversion, sexual abuse? How about anger? How about greed? How about arrogance? And how about the desire to be in control? Maybe more suffering from that one, maybe than all the others. I don't know. And there is a moral law. Next slide. There's a moral law. It's in the Bible, and it goes like this. You sin, you bring suffering into the world. In fact, suffering is evidence of God's displeasure at that thing. Exodus 20, verse 5 and 6. Now, we're going to read Exodus 25 and 6. When you read this, you might be made to feel a little bit uncomfortable with this passage. All right? But it is in the Bible. So if a Bible passage makes you uncomfortable, I guess that's supposed to be okay. All right? So let's read it. It says, I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sin of the parents to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to a thousand generation of those who love me and keep my commands. So according to this passage, when a person sins, the consequences, the suffering from that sin goes down to the third and the fourth generation. Now it seems like whoever wrote Ezekiel 18 and whoever wrote Exodus 20 should have had a conference call before they kind of wrote it, because something's not working right here. Because you know what it says there in Ezekiel 18, right? The soul who sins is the one who will die, and the son will not suffer for the sin of the father, and the father will not suffer for the sin of the son. Now, here's the thing. When you find two things in the Bible which seem at first glance to be in obvious contradiction, maybe if I do this, then I can move at least a foot and a half. All right, good. All right, let me say that again. When you find two statements in the Bible which seem to be in contradiction, that's actually going to be a place to learn something really awesome about God. All right, are we saved by works or by faith? Faith. Or by grace, you know? Well, you got James 2 and you got Ephesians 1. But if you understand how they're both true, then you go, ah. So, Ezekiel 18 is talking about the eternal consequences of sin. Before God, you are only responsible for your own actions. End of story. End of story. That's not what Exodus 20 is talking about. Exodus 20 is talking about the results in this life. In this life. In fact, I don't even think I needed to read Exodus 25 and 6 to know that this is true. If a husband beats his wife, who suffers? Well, his wife suffers. And yes, he suffers as well. And as do the children. And do the children of the children suffer down to the fourth or fifth generation? Absolutely. And like I said, there's a moral law. It's kind of like the law of gravity. Let's say I don't like the law of gravity. I just don't like it. I don't agree with it. It just seems to work that way. You sin, you bring suffering into the world. And that's part of how God created things. And again, I believe it's God's way of saying, no, that is not a good thing. That is not what I want. Okay? So, again, that explains a lot of suffering. But I'm telling you, it does not explain all suffering. I don't think anybody's sin caused COVID-19. Now, possibly somebody's sin caused that tower to go down there in Florida. I could see that. I could definitely see that. But I don't know. You know, I'm not here to judge on that one. But I'll tell you this. And by the way, I remember, I'm old enough, I remember the 80s, and Christians would say that AIDS is God's judgment on gays. It's like, excuse me, as if we have a right to say something like that. Tell that to a parent of a child who's dying of AIDS. And seriously. So, I believe most of the suffering in the world is because of rebellion against God. And we saw that in Exodus 20. Besides, I guess we kind of knew it. All right, great. So where would you go in the Bible to kind of learn stuff about suffering anyway? Job, very good. All right, now, Job's friends said the reason he's suffering is why? Because of his sin. Job says, I'm a righteous man. I don't deserve any of this stuff. Now, who is right? Now, they're both wrong. Actually, Bildad, I think, is not Elihu, the young guy. He was actually pretty close. I think his name is Elihu. They're both wrong because, number one, he definitely was not suffering because of his sin. How do we know that? Because we can read Job 1. He didn't have Job 1. We do. And no, he is not a righteous man. I'm sure he sinned a few times. In fact, you know what he deserved because of his sin? Eternal damnation. That's what he deserved. Now, here's the interesting thing, because a lot of what's going on in the book of Job is saying to God, why? There's another book, Habakkuk. Habakkuk, asking the same question. Now, in Habakkuk, God gives him the answer. But in Job, he never gave him the answer. We know why. In fact, at the end, God says to Job, just brace yourself like a man. Who are you? Were you with me when I laid the foundations of the deep? So that tells me something. It tells me that despite anything I might say and any conclusions you read from this talk, that does not mean that, therefore, you're going to be able to figure out why a particular suffering is in your life. And I tell you this, if somebody's suffering greatly, don't pull Romans 8:38. All things work out to the good of those who are called upon. Yeah, thanks. Is that what you want to hear right now? All things are work. The fact that your mom died, that's going to work out to the good, and you just should trust God. Seriously? Bad plan. All right. So there's got to be another cause of suffering besides that. I mean, John 9, right? John 9, the man born blind. There, obviously, he's born blind. Somebody's sin caused that. Jesus said, no, actually not. All right, so cause of suffering number two. So what's the cause of suffering number one? Sin. Not free will exactly, but if there were not free will, there wouldn't be sin. Okay? And my claim is a vast majority, especially of the kind of suffering that really, really, really gets us. It's because of sin. Cause of suffering number two is natural causes. Okay? By the way, could you just forward the slide and just kind of keep up with me? Because, yeah. Natural causes. All right? So, there you go. The tsunami. That's kind of an old example. Remember the tsunami hit Sumatra and killed 270,000, including many in Thailand, in Phuket. So whose sin caused that thing? Now, the imams in Sumatra, it's a kind of a radical Muslim area of Indonesia, they were saying it's because Allah was angry at people for not attending the mosque. Well, I'm not sure if God even wants people to go to a mosque, but never mind that. All right. Let me tell you why that happened. I'm going to tell you right now why that tsunami happened. It's called plate tectonics. Okay? The cause of that horrible event in human suffering was plate tectonics. All right, so the way it works, you probably already know this. I'm going to pretend you don't. So what happens is the pressure builds up from the convection currents and the heat inside of the earth. The pressure builds up, and it lets go. You guys had an earthquake just yesterday, right? Okay, good. You say, well, if God is so loving, why doesn't it just prevent earthquakes? Well, first of all, let's talk about plate tectonics. If it weren't for plate tectonics, because plate tectonics, what it does, it's like this massive recycling system. And if it weren't for plate tectonics, the surface of the earth would be sterile. There's a couple places on the earth that's had very, very, very little turnover. One is the Canadian Shield and part of Australia. And there's almost nothing growing there. So if it weren't for plate tectonics, the Earth's surface would be sterile. Also, if it weren't for plate tectonics, we'd have no atmosphere. All right? So if you want to go to a place where there's no plate tectonics, just go to Mars. You're all set. Okay? Except sterile and no atmosphere. That's not going to work out for you so well. So I would say to those who would challenge God on this, if you can invent a better universe than the one God did, be my guest. In other words, if you could create a sort of a world on which life can exist and physical laws that allow, you know, atmosphere and all that kind of stuff without plate tectonics, great. Let's hear your version of reality that make that happen. By the way, not only would you have to create that in your mind, you'd have to actually create it. So I'm not going to judge God on plate tectonics on Judgment Day. But the bottom line is, earthquakes happen and so do volcanoes. And it causes death. Now I'm going to talk about death in a bit. I'm going to talk about that. I'm not going to ignore that hard question. Okay, what about, the hurricane that hit Florida, I think, just yesterday? Really not. Oh, I think only one person died in that one. But there are hurricanes that cause tens of thousands of deaths. So, I mean, God is powerful, right? So I saw a hurricane, New Orleans, Katrina. So, I mean, Katrina's coming towards the coast of, you know, Louisiana. Why wouldn't God just sort of bend it away? I mean, why wouldn't he do that? Well, God seems to have created a universe that works according to laws that he created. And I'm not going to argue with God on that. So why would God make hurricanes and tornadoes and all that stuff? Well, let me give you a possible explanation. By the way, I think you knew this. The earth is round. Okay? The earth is round. And in order for life to exist, we need a source of energy. So what did God invent? Stars. Right? He invented stars. Now, we could talk about that awesome, amazing invention and how fusion works and all that. That's incredible stuff. But anyway, we have a point source of energy, roughly, and around Earth, and basically, the equator, way too hot, the poles, way too cold, and there'd be this little narrow strip, maybe a couple few hundred miles wide, that'd be just right, Goldilocks zone on the Earth. So instead, God made weather, and it spreads it all around, and humans can live almost anywhere on the Earth. Again, if you could think of a better way, for example, maybe you could create a universe where planets are cylindrical. That'd be better, right? So why are planets round? Because gravity makes round things, all right? And so what about diseases? All right, okay, fine, natural disease. What about diseases? You know, what about bacteria? Well, if it were not for bacteria, there'd be no nitrogen in the soil and no oxygen in the air and no vitamin K in your blood. In fact, I'm not a microbiologist, but I'm sure you could teach an entire course just explaining, spend the entire semester just explaining all the hundreds of things that bacteria does that nothing else does. And if it didn't do that, we wouldn't be here. All right, now, one of the things that bacteria does is it causes illness. All right? And, again, I'm not going to argue with God on bacteria. So, I believe that we've kind of reached the end of the story on why there's suffering. The reason there's suffering in the world is, number one, because of sin, and number two, because the bottom line is, nobody gets out of here alive. How many of you are planning on living forever? Okay? Did God create us to live forever? Not in these bodies. In fact, I would argue that death is actually a good thing. In nature, death is definitely a good thing, because without death, you don't have evolution. All right? And I believe that God did not create us to occupy these particular bodies forever. So I would argue that suffering is not evil. Next slide. Okay. All right, so what about pain? Now, by the way, I'm going to give sort of a trivial example, but I don't want to pretend that my trivial example just throws out the whole problem, the intellectual problem of pain. But again, why is there pain? Well, without pain, no male child would reach the age of 6. They would all be dead. All right? Mom says, don't touch, you'll get burned. Don't touch, you'll get burned. Don't touch, you'll get burned. What do they do? They touch, they get burned, and then they stop touching. In fact, if it were not for pain, I would have burst my stomach. All right, and I would have broken a leg and I would be crippled and unable to do anything. In fact, there's a tiny, tiny proportion, I don't know what it is, way, way, way less than 1% of humans who literally cannot feel pain. And that is a very dangerous and life-destroying problem. All right, pain is not evil. Pain is essential. Now, again, that doesn't allow me to just sweep under the rug why God allows extreme chronic pain over great periods of time. But I think we would acknowledge. And by the way, not only is physical pain essential.
John, because of your rebellion, people are suffering and they internet
all right. So they're going to force me.
They're going to force you right there.
They're going to force me. Okay. Sorry, internet people. I know how to sit in front of a microphone. I've been doing it for the last 15 months, you know, every Sunday morning. I just forget. All right. What was I saying? Yeah, and what about emotional pain? Emotional pain, that's God's sign. If you're feeling extreme emotional pain, God's trying to inform you of something. Pain is good. And death. Death is not evil. Isaiah 57:2, God takes them away to spare them from evil. Philippians 1:21, for me to live is Christ, to die is gain. All right, next slide. I want to talk about suffering. Like I said, there's an assumption happening here, as this atheist says, in what kind of world, you know, do you have animals getting killed by lions and all this violence and, you know, all this destruction? Actually, the one that God created. And suffering is not a bad thing. Psalm 30, verse 5, weeping may endure for the night, but joy comes in the morning. Now, in the world, it's kind of the other way around. Joy at night, weeping in the morning. All right? That's true. All right? In fact, I would argue that without suffering, there's no joy. Let's just stop there for a minute. I would argue that in this world, how heaven's going to work, I don't know. That's a big question for me. But in this world, if there is no suffering, there is no joy. And the more suffering, the greater the joy. I mean, we all get fired up when somebody gets married, but what about somebody who's been single for 30 years, has been waiting faithfully for 30 years? Oh man, we get fired up about that. And when does your food taste awesome? When you're really hungry. All right, and without suffering, there's no joy. So that raises questions about heaven. Is there suffering in heaven? That's one of those questions. They say, no more tears. Well, no, actually it says he wipes away every tear. I don't know. All right. John 9, 1 through 3. Again, suffering. Suffering is not even bad. Never mind evidence of God's lack of power. John 9, 1 through 3. Who sinned? This man or his parents? And what did Jesus say? No, this... He was born blind so that God's glory could be displayed. And I'd say one of the greatest ways that we can show God to the world is when we, as disciples of Jesus, experience suffering and understand how God works through suffering. In fact, I would imagine some of you would not even be saved today if God had not put you through some pretty serious suffering. I'd imagine... Some of you, you know, the whole plagues, right? Some of you, it was the eighth plague that finally got you to wake up and become a Christian. And are you going to blame God for bringing those things into your life? Whether he brought them in or somebody else did, you know, I'm not saying I can answer those questions. You know, we're not going to answer every question here, folks. We're just not going to be able to do it. All right, Romans 8:28. I already quoted it. Again, I want to caution you. How you use Romans 8:28. For we know that God works for the good in everything, right? Even in suffering. Even in suffering. Now I think about Jan's and my friend Elizabeth, who, Jan helped her become a Christian, and we moved off to Wisconsin, and Elizabeth wasn't faithful, at least for a few years. And, you know, her husband was kind of a jerk. actually. I guess he tried. And her daughter ended up with a lot of problems. We sent her to live with us in Wisconsin. We couldn't handle it. We sent her home. Anyway, we moved back to San Diego. We were there for about a year and a half. And Marcella, her daughter, was murdered. Her boyfriend put a bullet in her head with her child right there in the room. Okay, that's a pretty tough story. Now, I'm pretty sure I know why that happened, and it was not God's will. That was not God's will. There's no way. If you were abused by somebody, I guarantee you that was definitely not God's will. But God could still use it, huh? That boy was raised in a Christian home. All right, and he had a dad who was a drug addict, a drug dealer. The guy that she was living with is a drug dealer. She was all messed up. You know, God works things out for the good. Another thing about suffering is in Romans 5:3. Suffering produces character. Character produces hope, right? No pain, no gain. All right. In fact, you know, sometimes parents want to protect their kids from ever suffering. You know, oh, wouldn't want anybody to ever say anything bad to their kid, and certainly wouldn't want them to scrape their knee. You know what I'm saying? But suffering is required. All right. And in fact, really, if you're going to, you know, try to avoid suffering, just stay on the couch. You know, great. What kind of life are you going to have? Right. And besides, in 1 Peter 2:20 through 22, suffering is the natural result of doing good. All right. And in fact, oh, actually, my favorite on this really is Colossians 1:24. Think about it. Who does the world see as the truly great? Who does the world say is really great? I mean, even, you know, Buddhists, atheists, Muslims, Christians, whatever. Who are the truly great people that have lived? I don't know, Martin Luther King, Mother Teresa, Nelson Mandela. What do they all have in common? Incredible suffering and sacrifice. So even the world, even though they won't admit it, they understand that suffering is not bad. Colossians 1:24, my last one on this, before I get to part two, which is the emotional or human question about suffering. Colossians 1:24. This is one of those scriptures that when you read it, you go, is that what it actually says? Wow, I read that a few times. Really? That's what it says? Yes, it does. Colossians 1:24. Now I rejoice in what I'm suffering for you, and I fill up in my flesh what is still lacking in regards to Christ's afflictions for the sake of his body. So Christ's suffering is not sufficient? Well, actually, no, it's not. Because how do we really come to know Christ? How do you come to know Christ? It's through suffering. All right, so to kind of summarize so far, let's see what's on the next slide. Okay, now when we started this talk, I threw a couple points at you, said yes, I tricked you, and all of a sudden you felt like, wow, good point. Because if a God that we believe in is all powerful, he could do whatever he wants to, and if he's also loving and compassionate, then it seems hard to explain why there's cancer. Where does cancer fit into that plan? Okay? But in the end, I believe Christianity, or perhaps Judaism, and possibly even other monotheistic religions, maybe, provide the only answer to that question that works, that agrees with what we know about reality. And that is, the reason there's pain and suffering, it's not because God is weak or uncaring, but it's because he's so powerful and so loving. That he created a universe in which we are able to love him and to love one another. So God gave us free will, and unfortunately, most of us, like pretty much, I think, actually all of us, we rebelled against God. We did things that he said we shouldn't do, and the reason he said we shouldn't do them is because they're bad for us, because he loves us. And so most suffering is not the result of a weak or uncaring God, but it's the result of rebellion of beings that were loved by God and given free will. But that does not explain all suffering. And because a lot of suffering is just the natural result of being alive physically. Your body is going to wear out. I was doing a calculation. In about two months, I'm going to be exactly two-thirds of a century old. In about two months, I'll be two-thirds of a century old. All right, this body is wearing out. God did not create this body to last forever. And every single one of us is going to get sick and die. Okay? And it is natural. All right. So now I want to talk about the human response to suffering. Okay? Good. Actually, that you're on the right slide there. All right. So. Okay. So. Again, having given a rational, logical, reasonable explanation for why they're suffering, having shown that really the only worldview that's consistent with that explanation is a monotheistic worldview, having shown that, that does not solve the problem of suffering. Because guess what? When somebody dies, it's not fun. We experience tragedy. And honestly, it's devastating. So what is the Christian response? Not the rational answer. What's the Christian response to suffering? I believe that our response to suffering depends on our worldview. All right? So, for example, let's say we have the Hindu worldview. The Hindu worldview, they use the word Maya. Maya means illusion. And they argue that that the physical world, in essence, is an illusion, which that's doesn't seem that way to me, but they also argue that suffering is an illusion. Okay? Now, if you believe that suffering is an illusion, I think that would affect your response to suffering, don't you think? Now, I've been to India a few times. Guess who does the majority of benevolent works in India? Christian groups. By the way, there are also Hindu groups that do good work in India. But isn't that interesting? Because I believe Christians make up somewhere between 1% and 2% of the population, and yet they do a majority of the benevolent work in India. That's interesting. Why is that? It has something to do with the Christian response to suffering. Because if you say suffering is an illusion, I don't agree with that. And I don't agree with the response that it produces. And then there's the Buddhist worldview, which is, from our Western perspective, it seems kind of similar to the Hindu worldview. They're different. And basically, the Buddha said suffering is a result of caring. All right? Suffering is a result of caring. So what basically the Buddhist view is, first of all, that suffering is an illusion. But second of all, the response to suffering, the correct response to suffering is dispassion. In other words, moving away from feelings. Okay, so if you believe dispassion is the correct response to suffering, who do you think does the majority of benevolent works in Thailand, in Sri Lanka, in Vietnam? Again, it's Christian groups. Okay, because of the Christian view of suffering. Okay, what about the Muslim view of suffering? Who does most of the benevolent works in Muslim countries? The answer is Muslims, actually. Trust me, go to a Muslim country, and they do most of the benevolent work in their countries. Why? Because one of the five pillars of Islam is almsgiving. Okay? But there's a problem there, because in Islam, only to Muslims. Though that money is only able to use for Muslims. Boy, that's not the same as Christianity, huh? Not at all. Let's go to the next slide. I think maybe the next slide. I think there's a cool saying there. Oh, that's fine. We'll get to that later. So the Christians We don't believe that it's an illusion. All right? And not only that, but we believe that we have a responsibility to deal with suffering. Okay, what about the atheists? Atheists will condemn Christianity. What about the question of suffering? So what about that? What's the atheist's response to suffering? I don't know. It's been tried. We've had a couple of cultures that based their philosophy on atheism. We got Soviet Russia. That worked out great. All right, we got the Pol Pot regime in Cambodia. That was just really swimming, you know. And then we got the, you know, Red China, and we got the French Revolution. Four experiments in dealing with the question of suffering using atheism. In fact, I would believe, atheists, you know, try to attack Christianity, but I believe that almost everything they hold it important because they learned it from Christianity. All right, and they got this borrowed sort of pseudo worldview that they don't realize we gave it to them, but that's a whole other story. Because what I want to do is I want to finish out. I want to talk about the Christian response to suffering. And next slide. Oh, there it is. It's right there. It's compassion. The Christian response to suffering is compassion. Jeremiah 22:15-16. Does it make you a king to have more and more cedar? Did not your father have food and drink? He did what was right and just, so all went well with him. He defended the cause of the poor and needy, and so all went well with him. Is that not what it means to know me, declares the Lord? Not just helping the needy, but defending them against those who are putting them in position of need. We call it social justice. James 1:27. Religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this: to look after the orphans and widows in their distress and to keep oneself from being polluted by the world. Their problem is orphans and widows. Our problem, I think, is single moms and older people. Proverbs 14:31. He who oppresses the poor shows contempt for their maker. Whoever is kind to the needy honors God. Isaiah 58:6-7, as if we needed any more scriptures, because these go on and on and on and on. Is this not the kind of fasting I've chosen, to loose the chains of injustice, to untie the cords of the yoke, to set the oppressed free, to break every yoke? Here's that quote I was looking for. Maybe we can find it on the slide. If not, it's okay. This is Emperor Julian, who was the son of Constantine. You probably know who Constantine was, right? He was the emperor who made Christianity legal. His son was raised with Christians. He went to school with them, but he decided to return to paganism. And so he's commenting about Christians. By the way, I'm going to read this there. There's the quote. See the word atheism up there? He's talking about Christians. They called us atheists because we didn't worship this whole pantheon of gods. We just had one God. So atheism, in other words, Christianity, has been especially advanced through their loving service rendered to strangers. And through their care for the burial of the dead, it is a scandal. There's not a single Jew, he's talking about the Christians when he says that, there's not a single Christian who's a beggar, and that these godless Galileans care not only for their own poor, but for ours as well. While those who belong to us look in vain for the help that should render them. This is a guy who's, you know, the enemy of Christianity. And hospitals, the first hospitals were churches. And you know, Christians' response to suffering is compassion. Right? Hebrews 2:17-18. Let me read that. Who had the greatest compassion ministry in history, bar none? That's an easy question. Mother Teresa did pretty awesome. Seriously, she gets a lot of cred. But I'm pretty sure she would not even claimed to hold a candle to Jesus' ministry of compassion. Hebrews 2:17-18, where it says, for this reason he had to be made like them, fully human in every way, in order that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in service to God, and that he might make atonement for the sins of the people. Because he himself suffered when he was tempted, he is able to help those who are being tempted. Hebrews 4:15, which says, let me see. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to empathize with our weakness, but we have one who has been tempted in every way just as we are. Jesus suffered every way. You know the shortest verse in the Bible, right? Jesus wept. Why did Jesus weep? Not because Lazarus was dead. He was going to raise him from the dead in a few minutes, you know? The reason he was weeping is because Mary and Martha were weeping. That's why. That's the Christian response to suffering. Matthew 23:7. Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem. You who killed the prophets and stoned those sent to you. How often I've longed to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings. Compassion. Compassion is the correct response to suffering. So if you have a friend who lost a close relative from COVID, don't pull out Romans 8:28. Just listen to them. And don't say to them, what can I do to help? Don't say that, okay? Because trust me, that doesn't work. Just say, I'd like to do this for you. And they'll either say yes or no, okay? So I believe that Christianity offers the only rational, reasonable response to the intellectual quest of suffering. But I also believe that Christianity offers the only answer to suffering, the one that actually works, really, which is compassion. That's why I hope you have some pretty awesome programs going here. We got somebody who's been giving half of his life to helping with those who are suffering, right? He's trying to not acknowledge that because he's a humble guy. He's been to a lot of places to help prevent suffering. By the way, I believe the best way you can prevent suffering in people's lives is to help them become a Christian. You know that to the fourth generation? You know, if you were abused, it's going to affect your parenting. I don't care, Christian or not. Okay? That's just being real. But I believe it stops there. I believe it stops there. Amen? Let's finish in Matthew 9, verse 35 through 38. Matthew 9, 35 through 38. I hope this is a church which knows how to show compassion. Okay? We're given spiritual compassion. We're helping people become Christians. But Jesus didn't find out if you're a Christian yet before he healed you. Right? Matthew 9, 35 through 38. This is a passage we use for evangelism, and it is an evangelism passage, but I think if we read it correctly, it's an evangelism passage of a different sort than we think. All right? So here we go. Jesus went through all the towns and villages, teaching in their synagogues, proclaiming the good news of the kingdom, and healing every disease and sickness. That was Jesus' ministry. Healing, teaching, and preaching. And that needs to be part of every one of our lives. Healing, teaching, and I don't know about preaching, but some version of that. Okay? When he saw the crowds, he had compassion on them because they were harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. Then he said to his disciples, the harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. Ask the Lord of the harvest, therefore, to send out workers into the harvest field. Workers to do what? Well, look at the context. To show compassion. You know, this is an evangelism passage, but I think the form of evangelism is going out and showing compassion to people. Find something. Hopefully the church here has a particular ministry that you specialize in here locally that kind of everybody can get plugged into. And hopefully you have other things you do as well. All right, so that ends the talk. I don't know. We have time. It's 8:30. It's not that late. We could do some Q&A. Great. So any questions? Either directly related to this topic or another, I don't know, Bible question or apologetics question, anything. Whatever. We got some time. I should have forewarned you There's always that awkward silence whenever I ask anybody have a question. Who's playing in the NBA Finals?
John, let me step in there for a second.
Okay.
Well, let's give John a round of applause. All right. You know, I apologize for the technical issues today. You know, speaking of suffering, I mean, it's been, we were debating whether to do live stream or not. You know, I know that some of you know that Chris and Tabby's having a pretty tough pregnancy right now. She's been rushed to the hospital quite a few times.
Wow.
In the last few weeks. As Chris is trying to run to AB, trying to get things started. And AB has its own brand of suffering, believe you me. I mean, it's just, things don't work, you know, when you want them to. It's a lot of pressure on you. So I appreciate Chris. Just as we were doing this session tonight, Tabby again was rushed off.
Oh, my goodness.
And Chris had to go. So why don't we say a prayer, and then afterwards, I'd like to respond a little bit to John's lesson, great lesson, and then we'll have some Q&A as well. All right. Father, thank you so much for who you are. God, I know that in this world, there is suffering. There is no way around it. I know we try to shield it either by escaping it through our wealth or through detachment. Father, we just can't escape it. Father, I pray that we can learn the lesson and be compassionate, like John was talking about, and to share the good news of the gospel of Jesus.